You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we are April 1st, 2020. And I'm resisting the idea of talking about this virus nonsense. The partisan nature of it. I don't like the idea that I get dictated to by current events. But this is an area, you know, unfortunately, at least for a short time, I have to mention it. And I've already mentioned the main concept that this is a partisan question. If you remember, a few years ago, the Brennan Center and a few liberal think tanks were absolutely out of their minds trying to limit presidential emergency powers because Trump was talking about the border, which is, you know, opening the border is a sacred idea to them. And they were attempting to limit the emergency powers that he had. The Atlantic magazine put out this, that is the terrifying amount of emergency powers that the president has. And of course, they only really cared about, attacking Donald Trump. The attacks on Donald Trump, since this virus became a cause célèbre, are, you know, ridiculous. He hasn't reacted enough. He's reacted too much. He can do nothing right. One thing they don't mention, though, is the extent of his emergency powers. The Brennan Center put out, right after he was elected, which is no accident, the Brennan Center for Justice put out a guide to emergency powers and their use, which is at the New York University School of Law. And it's actually a very handy, roughly a 50-page summary of the powers of the president in an emergency. Very little has any reference to the outbreak of disease. There really is no guideline there. Nothing mentions the closure of public businesses. All of these emergency powers, if you go through them all, and some of them haven't been invoked in a very long time, have to do with the president's power over the federal government. So, for example, during World War II, there was this alleged right that FDR had to essentially take over the entire economy. And the federal government was able to bring, you know, automakers to make military equipment and stuff like that. Now, there's been governors, the mayor of Chambersburg and here in Pennsylvania, the governor of Florida, and a few other places that have refused to shut down businesses on several grounds, one of which is that there is no emergency power to dictate to private businesses when they can function, when they can't. And the other is that the concept of essential and non-essential is arbitrary. The one problem with this virus outbreak is that you have a lot of really rich guys who are in trouble. The economy is without question going to go into a depression. It was heading there anyway, but now they have an excuse. But no one is really talking about the emergency powers of a president. There is no law when it comes to disease that permits this. Emergency powers have to do with the president's, essentially the cancellation of the of the three branches of government and to create more of a centralized system. You know, calling up reservists, and one of them is the that they can very quickly approve experimental drugs in a case of an outbreak. Nothing, at least nothing explicitly mentions the idea of closing businesses. And certainly nothing talks about massive financial bailouts. But as I've said many times before, that's what this is. There aren't enough deaths that can be directly connected to this virus to justify any state of emergency. If you note the statistics, they say virus-related deaths, because the number of deaths directly connected to the virus is relatively few. Those who are already ill are would be in the same boat if they got any kind of, you know, if they got pneumonia, if they got any other, you know, any other kind of disease that would push them over the edge. The number of people who die just solely from the virus is not many, and this isn't really being discussed anyway. And of course, you know, flu deaths continue to outstrip, or I could even say overdose deaths outstrip that of this virus. So the bottom line is that this is a way to introduce the concept of economic depression that was already developing and a massive bailout system that was already in the works. Now they could blame this. The fear and terror that people are operating under will now justify anything. It has nothing to do with whether or not government has the right to, you know, tell you about assembly or opening and closing a business. It's that people are too frightened to say anything one way or the other. But yeah, after Pearl Harbor, no one was going to tell FDR that he couldn't take over the economy. But when you have, you know, pretty much high-level elites losing a lot of money, you have to begin asking questions. The only people who truly benefit are those who are buying up stocks at fire sale prices and getting these monstrous bailouts. The banks have received several $1 trillion already, and what has already been passed to send to the taxpayer is allegedly $1,500 a household, which is an absolute pittance compared to what the banks are getting. While bad debts of the banks and other corporations are being bought up, which is, you know, being canceled, no one is talking about the cancellation of private debts from ordinary citizens. So, as far as the virus is concerned, that's my, you know, I've mentioned this elsewhere, but the emergency powers are pretty limited. I've said this before, but, you know, in U.S. law, the definition of major disaster, which, of course, underlies all emergency powers, it refers to any natural catastrophe, like, you know, any hurricane, tornado, etc., regardless of cause, any flood, fire, explosion, any part of the U.S., and with the determination of the president causes damage of sufficient severity to warrant a major disaster assistance under this chapter, supplement the efforts available to states, which in alleviating damage, loss, hardship, or suffering caused thereby. And yet, when you're talking about a nation with, or a country with 7,000 hospitals and allegedly 120,000 people infected by this, and that's highly questionable. I live across the street from a level one trauma center, and I am not seeing any difference in how they're operating. I'm not seeing any crush of people. I'm not seeing any traffic jams. I'm not seeing any of the medevac helicopters are not traveling anymore. I'm not hearing ambulances or anything like this. Now, if anything is happening in hospitals, it's a lot of people who are suffering from psychosomatic illnesses. If you remember my lecture on Chernobyl, the overwhelming majority of those checking themselves into hospitals were psychosomatic. There wasn't much, contrary to popular belief, radiation released there. But the government of Ukraine really took advantage of that to receive billions of dollars from the outside world, as well as subsidies. But most of the people who showed up in hospitals were not actually ill. The real tragedy was, of course, the huge number of abortions that took place because mothers were frightened that this massive release of radiation was going to destroy their babies. There was an upsurge in illnesses, but unfortunately that was the case throughout the Soviet Union, and not just in Ukraine. Of course, there are people who are still living within a mile of Chernobyl. Chernobyl is abandoned only because the city existed entirely for the plant. Once the plant was gone, no one had any reason to live there anymore. So if you see these stupid articles about, you know, two-headed dogs and stuff like that, it's nonsense. The exclusion zone is 1 mile, and farmland is being ceded, you know, a few miles away. The point is that what really mattered there was this massive influx of people claiming to be ill, that everything that happened was blamed on this. And you did have a crush on hospitals at the time, which were already in bad shape. And then that the system used this to attract subsidies. So the government at the time took advantage of this, and to some extent still is, because not only were they getting subsidies internally, but also from international agencies and governments. And so they had families that were claiming radiation damage were given a subsidy on top of that. So the government had an incentive to exaggerate what happened there, as did the average person. And this may well be the case here. The only positive things, of course, is that it is delaying debt collections. People like me who do struggle under debt are given a bit of a breather. The normal run of bill collection has been interrupted. You know, the IRS was really behind to begin with. They're understaffed on top of it, and now they're way behind. And of course, I believe the filing date in the U.S. has now been pushed back to mid-July. So as far as the bailout of the average person is concerned, this $1,500 check, I'll believe it when I see it. But I do want to note that many of the Democrats were attacking the idea of giving the average American any kind of money. And you do have Republicans saying that, you know, free money is against our principles. Bailing out the banks, of course, is absolutely no problem. All right, that's the virus talk for now. Today is April Fool's Day. And this isn't even what I wanted to talk about. But very quickly, I know there's a lot of theories as to its origin. And no one's entirely sure what theory is correct. But I came across a Reader's Digest article that said that this derives from this alleged Roman, initially Greek, feast of Herelia, the Feria Stativa, allegedly on the 25th of March. In honor of Cybele, the alleged mother of the gods. Now, in the Greek version, this is the claim that it's one of these carnival situations where everything's inverted. The notion of a carnival, that's not the literal meaning of the term, but carnival is where, you know, the bad dominates the good, children dominate parents, etc. It's an inversion of things. That's why it's so important to the occult sciences. The Greek version, of course, was that the Hilaria were any day of rejoicing. But the claim, I'm seeing this more and more, is that it comes from this alleged 25th of March celebration. And in 1875, you have a dictionary of Greek and Roman antiquities. William Smith wrote the following. The manner of its celebration during the time of the Republic is unknown, except that Valerius Maximus mentions the games in honor of the mother of the gods. Respecting its celebration at the time of the Empire, we learn from Herodian that, among other things, there was a solemn procession in which the statue of the goddess was carried, and before the statue were carried the most costly specimens of plate and works of art belonging either to wealthy Romans or to the emperors themselves. Now, of course, the point of him saying this is to suggest that, and he's talking about things like May crownings and that the Western processions derive directly from this. And he cites authorities. You know, he cites Severus Alexander, the History of Augustus, and Macrobius. And he claims that this is, you know, this is his authority. And of course, I read exactly where he cites this from, and they don't say this at all. There was a legend, it was considered a legend at the time, that the Romans wanted a goddess statue to be brought to Rome. That may or may not have been connected with this at all. He refers to the mother of God and it's Persephone who was being venerated here, who was never considered the mother. In fact, there was none of these entities that were considered the mother of God. This is strictly a Christian idea. But he's deliberately using that language and, of course, carrying them in the solemn procession. Well, there's no mention of that anywhere. But then, at the end of Smith's explanation, he says, and by the way, when he describes this, he said, it seems that this is the case, not that it is the case. Then at the very last sentence, he says, it must, however, be observed that the Hilaria are neither mentioned in the Roman calendar nor in Ovid's Fasti, which, of course, is more or less his summary of pagan rites. So in other words, he says, this does not exist in the calendar, and he is deliberately misreading sources to try to claim that the processions of the statues of Mary are derived from this Hilaria. Somehow, this has to do with April Fool's Day because this was a carnival situation also where people, you know, where everything was inverted. Now, I've seen this in two or three places now, and of course the idea is to try to connect this to to the Western processions of the statues of Mary and processions with icons, and this is where this derives from. But of course, this is not on any calendar, and Ovid does not mention it, and the citations that he uses don't mention any of this. So it's one of these things where he deliberately tries to make it seem like it's the origin of Western Catholic processions, and then cites, you know, very obscure sources that he assumes no one's going to go and read. Well, I did, and they don't say any of this. I have several lectures on this topic, the notion that, you know, Christianity was this pagan, whatever paganism is, I have never gotten a definition of it. You know, it's really, you know, it's kind of like I mentioned in the yoga thing. It's like Hinduism. It's a word that foreigners came up with to unify a whole bunch of practices. You know, it's essentially native customs. You know, under one word. You know, it's not a theology or anything. That it's just a copy of pagan practices. And of course, when you actually take these apart, it's never the case. Because it's assumed that no one's going to actually go back and read the fragments that remain. Here you have a situation where the guy is deliberately distorting. He's deliberately distorting the record to make it seem like this. Again, with the understanding that the people who have the wherewithal to read this kind of thing, one of them is strictly in Latin, they're all, the citations he has are all post-Christian anyway, but they're typically not going to go in and look at this, and they're just going to take it at face value. Anyway, that's just a side note, and it's something that's come up on this lecture show before. Now, if things were normal, if this virus wasn't happening, and again, I'm anxious to see the psychological fallout of this over the next few months, and of course, terrified of the economic fallout. In terms of mass unemployment, small businesses going under. I mean, the central economic issue is big businesses can weather this storm, and certainly if they're being bailed out anyway. Small businesses most certainly can't. But I've heard from more than one, even mainstream sources, that an economy that can't handle even a few weeks without a paycheck, without a massive bailout, is an economy that was completely irrational. But if you want to know what oligarchy is, you see it in these bailouts. But if things were normal, if you didn't have this virus, I would have talked about Alexander Dugin and his approach to Plato. And I'm going to do that anyway. Now, as far as I know, nothing on Dugin and Plato has been translated. I've had to go back to the Russian. The problem with anyone analyzing Alexander Dugin is that the overwhelming majority of his works, and he's voluminous by this point, he's written a tremendous amount of stuff, is still in Russian, and difficult Russian. You can't use Google Translate for Dugin. The verbiage is too specialized. But Plato is absolutely essential to him, and like me, he makes the argument, which was commonplace not too long ago, that Western civilization is based on Plato, and Orthodoxy is based on Plato, in a very broad sense. I was a Platonist before I became a Christian. I think I became a Christian because of Plato's Republic, which I first read when I was roughly 17. I read the Gorgias first, which is my favorite dialogue, and the Republic after that. And for the first time, I saw things like the spirit and free will and the notion of a disembodied idea justified intellectually, which I had never heard before. But that's why Plato was so important. It's not an accident that God chose to send the Logos at the time when he did. He sent them to a crossroads area in the fringes of the empire, but still a culturally Greek area, Decapolis, which is what Galilee, the Roman name for it. And, of course, I have a whole lecture on where Nazareth was and its connection to Greek culture. It was a Hellenized area. And Christ, growing up, had access to all the traditional Greek theater and works of philosophy in Sepphoris, which was the main city that Nazareth was attached to. That's not an accident. The Roman Empire was known for its roads and communication, and the dominant philosophical school was some variation of Plato. Now, it's true that the church in various councils over the years have condemned what it calls Platonism. When I put that in quotes, what they're referring to is Neoplatonism. And they're referring to what Dugin calls dualistic Neoplatonism, or a perversion of Platonism that descended into magic and occult rites. You see this rising in fact, this is exactly what the Renaissance refers to. This resurrection of that particular, Ficino and Mirandola talking about Plato, not Plato the philosopher, but his students, the Neoplatonists, who descended into some kind of alchemical and magical intellectual idea. That is not what we're talking about here. The church cannot condemn Plato as such, obviously because he was prior to the New Testament, but of course the great church father, my favorite church father, Justin Martyr, was an open and very loud Platonist, as was Origen. And very much like me, Justin Martyr came to Christ through Plato. And you've seen, I've seen icons, not with a halo, but, you know, icons that show a certain veneration to the ancient Greeks as precursors to the Christian world. And because Plato was so extremely important to all the church fathers, that can't be denied. So it's not an accident that Christ was sent to earth at this extremely auspicious time. Now, as far as Alexander Dugin is concerned, we have a very similar approach. Of course, back when I was in college, I had no access to him. His early works were from the early 90s. I couldn't read Russian at the time. I never heard of the guy. But his work on Plato is substantial. And the way he approaches it, and again, I have no problem with most of this, but Plato's work is based around the idea of unity. The good, and something is good in the same respect, no matter how it manifests itself, whether it be in politics or science. Truth, goodness, and beauty are one and the same thing seen from three different points of view. They're all aspects of a single order that, from our point of view, comes from logos. This is a vertical order, as Dugin will call it, that descends from the idea to phenomena. When we talk about idea in Plato, there's three words that are used synonymously: archetype, form, and idea. And these are used with capital letters to show that they're technical terms. And Dugin says, this order predetermines the normative structure of man, the world, society, and knowledge. Man is a link in the chain of ideas. He's stretched between the beginnings. He carries out by himself, through his existence, the translation of one to another. As a demiurge, gods and luminaries, he creates the order of the cosmos. He reflects the order of the cosmos, organizes copies, and he dissolves phenomenon in the contemplation of ideas. Creation and contemplation are two aspects of man. And there he has noesis and poetry as creation and contemplation. For something to be cosmic is to be ordered. It derives from the ideas. He says, cognition is also carried out. It brings ideas into objects and brings objects into ideas. And the state is an aspect of this order. The state is just one aspect of this cosmic world. It's not reflected, but the order is expressed. Classes descend also from idea to object or phenomenon. Philosophers create the state in the same way the ideas create the world. Created, in quotes, manifested. The ideas or forms are above things, and that ideas are the source of value. Again, I should say form rather than idea, even though both are used synonymously. Archetype with a capital A. Without Plato, it is almost impossible to understand the tradition of the West. The traditionalist movement with a capital T, you know, the Gounods and Evolas, despite their problems. I mean, even Seraphim Rose was a big fan of both. At one point, they were a stepping stone. Used Plato as the central foundation to everything. And that his ideas can be found in almost every intellectual system since civilization was founded, for better or for worse. although usually in the dualistic form. The concept is the one or unity. It must be single. It must be monarchical. The Platonic state is royal. Now, there is no such thing as an absolute ruler. That's never existed. It can never exist. A ruler requires, no matter how good he is, requires servitors. Requires not just assistants with different specialties, but they have to be good themselves. Politics is the art of taking this oneness, this unity, and bringing it to the state. There is no will to power because power is truth. Those who find the truth, those who are in the realm of truth, are already in the realm of power. This is why Socrates asks the question, or actually answers the question, it's still worthwhile doing good things, even if you never get the reputation of being good. That it's worth doing good things, even if it causes you to get the reputation of being evil. It's still worthwhile, it's still good in itself. Those who strive for power won't reach truth. Now, the central, one of the central approaches that Dugin uses is in the Parmenides. One of the more difficult of the dialogues I read in college and grad school about 10 trillion times. And there are 8 hypotheses there. Now, these are hypotheses in metaphysics that Dugin is going to connect with politics. And of course, the first I've already mentioned, the one, the center, the origin. This isn't knowable. The unity beyond unity, being beyond, even being has to have an origin. You know, governments and states can't be self-identical. It can't exist for itself. It can't be self-created. It has to be built around something. It has to be built in light of something. The apophatic theology is based on the idea that this one, this unity, isn't knowable in the sense that we can never experience a unity like this. Because even if we were to picture something unified, which in and of itself is an odd thing to say, it's still just going to be a piece of something. It's beyond any experience. In the Russian royalist tradition, you see this in Saint Philaret and so many others, Ivan Ilin, the notion of the state being part of this cosmic unity is essential for it to be respected. And this is why royalism is so important. This is where all the pomp and the liturgy is. This isn't arbitrary. The ignorant say that this is, men created this. Well, these are ancient understandings. It's acting out something that doesn't exist in time or space, but we are in time or space, and that's a problem. How do you act out timelessness in time? How do you act out spacelessness in space? And that's what liturgy is. Everything that royal families do, and I don't care where you go, everything royal families do is liturgical. But you found this in all estates in society. But the state can never exist by itself. The minute the state concerns with its own interests, it's not a state anymore. In order for this to be the case, philosophy, in the very broad sense, has to rule it. In other words, ideas. That doesn't mean philosophers as such rule the state. It simply means people with this access to truth and with this intuitive understanding of truth have to form the constitution. And again, constitution isn't a piece of paper. But other than this unity, of course, then there is what comes from it. Multiplicity. No ruler can rule by himself, no matter how good he is. No one, no matter how intelligent or well-intentioned can know everything. It's the very nature of this unity that it break apart into many aspects, especially if you're a human being and we can't know everything. There has to be, you know, a society is created. I have a paper on this topic, actually, that the ideas, the archetypes actually come from social functions. Things absolutely necessary for human life are built into human nature. And these specialties, they could be, law enforcement or the, you know, economy and finance, whatever it is, have to have people around this central core. But of course, the idea of the monarchy is to harmonize them all into one thing. They do derive from one thing, and they have to be harmonized around one thing. But the third is one and many together, the so-called world soul. And in Plato's idea, this is the so-called guardians. Again, with Plato, you know, don't take these concepts too literally. You know, philosopher king isn't, you know, some guy with, you know, with a tweed jacket. This is someone with this intuitive understanding. A leader in the true sense of the word. Someone like, you know, even like a judge like Gideon in the Old Testament. These are the people who take this knowledge of the truth and manifest it in day-to-day life. And not just that, but guard it in every way. Guard it intellectually and guard it physically. The main job of a bishop in a church isn't just administration. That's secondary. It's as apologists. They have to defend the church. They have to defend this knowledge of the truth to everyone. Now, in Plato's idea, you have lower orders. Now, again, I don't like using class because class has more to do with, it sounds like it has more to do with income and money and wealth. No, this has to do with function. Wealth isn't even an issue here. But underneath the guardians are the different corporations, for lack of a better word. These are the artisans who do the day-to-day work in society, not just in government. They're associated with the particular things of matter, making things, doing things. And of course, the lowest of all are those who don't make things. Finance. People who sell for the sake of selling. Not that they're not necessary. Of course, you need a strong merchant class. No one denies that. But we live in a carnival where those who don't make anything dominate those who do. Now, of course, philosophers don't make anything physically either, but they don't exist in the realm of matter to begin with. People who do make things only because those who exist in the realm of idea give them the patterns. And it's not this, these aren't just physical creatures. These people are skilled in their specific area and they're organized in corporations. Now, outside of a well-ordered state, truth simply doesn't exist. It's chaos in the worst sense of the word. Now, underneath that, Dugin uses Aristotle. Now, those are the three hypotheses, really three or four. But then there's three negative, you know, Aristotle's famous distinction between tyranny, oligarchy, and democracy versus monarchy, aristocracy, and the mixed polity. From the fifth to the eighth hypothesis in Parmenides, Aristotle finishes this list. Now, there is a negative aspect to all of these hypotheses. So there is a unity to evil, as you know, the golden calf or Antichrist, the Adam Kadmon, the secret tyrant. And around that, you have the global oligarchy, the super wealthy, the people who are getting these massive bailouts. the, you know, so-called Committee of 300, the most powerful, wealthy people on the planet. And then those who serve them, the democracy, the cattle-like plebs, those that are easily mobilized in the cities. You know, the violence of revolution. We talked last week about the Reds opening up the prisons. This is the lowest of the low. Aristotle said that there are three very general forms of state, the royal, the aristocratic, and I don't want to say popular, it's called polity in English. It's a mixed system, which is the lowest of the three, but still very, very good. There are three that are perversions. Monarchy is perverted into tyranny. And the distinction there is that the royal, of course, is dedicated to the truth and therefore to the nation that he has to rule. A tyrant cares only about himself. He cares only about power for its own sake. An aristocracy is the same thing. These are the best and wisest and the most experienced, dedicated to the common good. It's very easy for them to become oligarchs who care only about money and about themselves. And those are one and the same. If you care about money, you only care about yourself. And then democracy as the lowest. Democracy, even in the founding generation of the United States, right up until almost the 20th century, the word democracy was a curse word. It referred to people who don't know anything, who only care about their stomachs, using physical force and threats to get what they want. Now, we mentioned the Reds, you know, opening up the prisons. This is the opposite of the mixed polity. This is the opposite of popular justice. These are the last people you want to be forcing anyone to do anything. They are the most ignorant in Plato's sense. And that's how Dugin kind of fills out the eight hypotheses of the Parmenides by using Aristotle from the most ethereal, beyond being, beyond words, beyond knowledge, to the very lowest of the low, almost non-existent, hunks of matter in motion. And to a great extent, they're not part of any state at all, which is why they're in prison. Aristotle would also call them slaves. When he referred to slavery, he wasn't referring to people who were owned by someone else. He was referring to people who simply don't have the capacity to think for themselves, either because they're born that way or because they found it easier to live that way. To give these people any kind of power, whether it be voting or juries or anything else, was national suicide. And only the worst of the revolutionaries would do that, not because they want to, they'll execute these people the minute they're no longer useful, but it's to create as much chaos as humanly possible. I don't know if you've noticed, but some of the prisons have been opened in America. The sheriff of Los Angeles County, many of you have seen this, has opened up the prisons and at the same time closed gun stores. So they're letting prisoners out, although I would think that jails would be the safest place. How would they be infected in there? Who are they coming in contact with? They're letting them out and at the same time making sure that people can't defend themselves against them. Every violent revolution either has or demanded the opening of the prisons. The French revolutionaries did the exact same thing. Because truth, this isn't democracy. This is, or it is democracy in the classical sense. It's the lowest of the low. It's sheer matter in motion. But matter in motion really doesn't exist. Matter in motion needs an engine. It needs someone to mobilize them. That's what oligarchy does. Oligarchy doesn't lead anything. Oligarchy manipulates people. And the notion of the Parmenides, the hypotheses, is going from the most ethereal, non-material, to things that are just material. But when the just material is human, that's where you have tragedy. Because you're not supposed to be. A human being is rational and therefore free. Those are the two things that make a human being a human being. Otherwise, they're just a walking corpse. Death isn't merely someone in a casket or someone in a grave. You could be dead and have your heart beating. It's not just a biological state. It's a mental state. Aristotle's notion of a slave is merely somebody who simply cannot think rationally, who goes by impulse, pure self-interest, just matter in motion. But of course, these people are also very easy to manipulate. And therefore, they have to be controlled one way or the other, and they end up in prison. Now, of course, they're running Goldman Sachs. This is the devia. This is why modernity is so evil. It is the inversion of the Platonic idea. But this is a whole notion of modernity, is taking the perversion of Plato's state and Aristotle's three ideas and putting them in charge of things. The British Revolution was the oligarchy of London joining up with the oligarchy in Amsterdam, of course, with strong Jewish assistance, and overthrowing the crown and using some vulgar form of Protestantism in order to do this. This is the idea. And so for Plato, the idea is the metaphysics connects with the political. The monarchy is connected with the one, the unity, the truth as such. An aristocracy around him, and it could only be around him, because an aristocracy by itself becomes oligarchy. One of Dugin's important points, and I've made this point before, is that an aristocracy without a monarchy becomes oligarchy almost by definition. And then a virtuous population. A virtuous population doesn't exist as individuals. It exists in corporations. And of course, so for the three elements of Aristotle, you really add a fourth, which is the corporation. So you get the eight hypotheses. And for Dugin, this is what politics is. It has nothing to do with issues. It has nothing to do with what you read in the paper. It has nothing to do with what the talking heads are talking about. It has nothing to do with current events, although current events may manifest it. It has to do with the truth. The truth and any specific idea is not hard to find. I've been saying this since I was a teenager. The conditions, though, is that you have to be rational and therefore free, or free and therefore rational, and all self-interest has to be put to the side. You have to not care what the conclusion of your study, where it will lead you. But Dugin also says that this is an initiatory idea. Well, that's not some sort of a New Age concept. Initiation simply means that the person who has this kind of sensitivity to go into the realm, go beyond matter, into the realm of ideas, which is very hard to do, and it's a very difficult life, you can't do it on your own. It's never been done. Socrates called himself a midwife, someone who gives birth to that in younger people who have this sensitivity. And I've said many times, the sheer amount of information that's available on any particular topic out there is so overwhelming that it's almost impossible without guidance to be able to tell the truth from the false. We come to know things because we come from the same unity as the things that we're trying to know. Things in the political order are right or just in the same way. What is that concept of justice? What holds it all together? Dugin says that the decay from the classical to the modern is essentially a descent from the idea to the object. The modern to the postmodern is the object to now nothing. There's nothing behind it. It's simply a word. And we talk about things like nominalism, this is what I'm talking about. I've done lectures on this before. And Dugin's idea of the postmodern is that words take the place of things. Science isn't even talking about objects anymore. They're simply talking about concepts they create. But that means those who have the power to label things have the power to create things, because everything is merely words and emotion. I mean, at least the modern was referring to logic, and it had something to do with the outside world. The postmodern rejects the outside world entirely and reduces everything to labels and terms. And this is when Adam Cadman, Antichrist, shows himself, because now the concept of reality has been overthrown. People can be incorrect and wrong and mistaken, but still live in the same world you do. In the postmodern idea, at least in Dugin's thinking, they can't be wrong because you're not in the same world. When you reject the idea that there's any individuals at all, any individual things at all, and everything is just a term, everything is just a word. And most philosophy is usually word games. Again, it means those who can label things create them. It's a complete opposite, the total inversion, the carnival inversion of the creation of the heavens and the earth. But people are rational, therefore free, free, therefore rational. Well, reason, at a minimum, is the ability to, from the point of view of the foundation of truth, make a decision. You have many choices in front of you. You could work your way through which one is the best. That implies that you're free to choose any of them. The minute you reject the spirit, the minute you reject any kind of soul, you can't be rational because freedom is gone. This is why no one can really be a materialist. No one can be a behaviorist. Because once you eliminate the idea of freedom, you can't really say anything to me, because I have no idea if any of this is actually true or just something necessary. The opposite of this is, of course, the Platonic archetype. Ideas, Dugin calls them flashes of unchanging light. But because we're human beings born in a very sick age, all we have access to are these flashes. And there are people who dedicated their life to these flashes. They never change. You can't have any kind of a science unless you begin by the idea that truths are unchanging. Now, they may manifest themselves differently, but basic truths of the world cannot change, or else you can't have a science. Things that in the modern world that were considered, you know, brilliant cutting-edge science 100 years ago are laughed at today. That did not exist in the classical world, did not exist in the medieval world. Meeting with the idea, the archetype, this flash of light, changes you forever. The idea is the highest value. It doesn't serve anything. It doesn't belong to anyone. And it doesn't have any practical meaning. None of this has to do with utilitarianism. Utility is a perversion. Now, the phenomena, the things that we come across in day-to-day life, these are copies. They're slaves to ideas in Dugin's world. And as slaves to the ideas, they're distorted ideas. They're only vague. They're perceived by the senses. The things that we see and come across every day don't have their own being. They're not real. Their individuality is an error in relation to the idea that created them. But the phenomena that we come across can lead us to truth. And this is what Dugin means by the vertical idea. Because objects we come across are manifestations of the idea that gives them birth, we can see the universal truth in each thing that we come across. But that requires a tremendous amount of work. The ignorant only see a hunk of matter that they want to dominate. The philosopher sees truth manifested in one thing. Science, in the true sense, in the classical sense, is to take material objects and connect them with their corresponding idea. So we see an act that we consider just. The only way that we know it's just is to know what justice is in the first place. Or we can't use the term. If the idea of justice is always changing, then the word becomes meaningless. This is what's absolutely essential. This is the foundation of everything that we do. Now, as far as this crazy virus is concerned, this is the ultimate postmodern experiment. And now you have a handful of scientists connected to the state, connected to corporate capital, connected to the media, who now are in charge of deciding what's real and what isn't. This isn't science in the classical sense. These people care about self-interest. They care about the fact that they're very powerful right now and that there's a lot of money at stake. The postmodern is the nominal. And this is really the ultimate expression of what Dugin is talking about. It's been very rare before me and a handful of others to say that nominalism is the root of all evil. I'm pretty sure I'm the first one to say that, although, of course, I that's existed before. There's a handful of others, especially in the East, that made that same claim. Dugin has made that same claim in the past. If you believe that everything that we see originates in the mind, then it isn't real. But we can't just create our own reality. We'll be put away. Well, then who creates it? Well, the minute you reject God, the minute you reject cosmic order, it has to be those who are powerful, the titans of industry. So let me try to clarify this as I conclude it. I have a book, my magnum opus, I guess you can call it, which I don't know when this thing is ever going to come out, on nominalism in the Orthodox Church. And it starts off with the idea of struggle. The struggle is to break ourselves free from the individual object, including ourselves. The notion of preparation. Asceticism is the drive to see the spirit encased in matter. When we refer to grace, when we refer to light, we're referring to this spirit, the truth that's manifest in physical things, the soul of the world, that is, or the soul of anything in particular. That does not change. That isn't physical. That's this flash of light. And as society gets more and more corrupt, and we move farther and farther away from the truth, these flashes are going to be fewer and very much farther between. God joined himself to man through Christ, which of course, because people say this over and over again, it dulls us. But to be baptized, we become a part of the non-physical world. We're not separated from God in the sense that God exists in this autonomous sphere of earthly life, or that we exist in a sphere of earthly life, that something is separate from heaven and the light. But we are still part of it. We're ontologically distinct. so long as we maintain the struggle. None of us are pure. We're born in a very sick part of human history. We're born in the Iron Age, the Kali Yuga, some say. The phenomenal man is saturated in sin. But we also have a noumenal self. There's a primary ontological distinction between those who are baptized and those who are unredeemed. The Orthodox man has the opportunity of being raised above the fallen world of nature. That is to say, nature taken in its lowest form, blind force, passion, coercion. Politically, we're referring to those who the regime lets out of prison. Blind force, passion, and coercion. They, of course, are controlled by oligarchs. It's simply organized blind force, passion, and coercion. The fullness of grace is present at baptism, confession, the Eucharist. It doesn't automatically permit us to be the proper receiver of it. The ascetic life does that. The ascetic life is to break through the individual. The ascetic life permits man over time to see God within created nature, to see his activity. The ascetic can begin to see the universal embedded in particular nature, and nature, therefore, is not just blind force, as most people see it, but the habitation of grace, of God and his power. God isn't up in the sky somewhere, but exists in a very different dimension of reality, the same reality where the ideas are to be found. Still immanent in creation, but not identified with it. He exists with us in the fullness of power, but sin and passion obscure his presence. The more we see just hunks of objects, matter in motion, the more sinful we are. The unredeemed see creation as blind force manipulated by powerful people. The ascetic sees a natural order, the cosmic order, manifest in God's power. Nominalism is the belief that only hunks of matter being pushed around by some blind force is all that exists. That's the difference. The entire modern world, the industrial world, is based on the idea of nominalism. But in Dugin's ideas, the notion of the postmodern goes even farther than that. The hunks of matter don't exist anymore. They've been replaced by words. Words expressed in images, on screens, by media elites. They're the only ones who have the power to replace matter itself. So the postmodern for Dugin is horrifying. It's the same phenomenon that can cause a headline that says, you know, Indonesia has 10 deaths under martial law. Well, normally, a rational person will laugh at that. How can it be under martial law with a handful of deaths? But when you've already had this image of this worldwide slavery, this pandemic that's being thrust on us, well, it doesn't matter. The number doesn't matter. Reason doesn't matter. Freedom doesn't matter. Because reason and freedom are essentially one and the same thing. And let it be known that I'm the first one to connect the virus and clamp down on it with Plato and Dugin's analysis of Plato. I could connect anything with anything. But there is a connection here. Dugin's idea is that the modern at least deals with objects. You know, Newton's laws of motion. He's still referring to things. Things in a vacuum, but things. The postmodern says even the things don't exist, and they're words, and words only. And even worse than that, emotions, feelings that you can find on a screen. It should bother you that reporters dictate everything. Reporters and media and the editors decide what's important, what the big issues are, what the acceptable arguments are. What's real? What isn't real? None of these people are specialists in any of these areas. You know, Plato would laugh at this. The whole Platonic idea is that these people just can't be writers. They have to be knowledgeable in this specific area. You can't send some guy from New York to Western China and tell him to start reporting on things. He has to be a specialist in the area. That means you're getting news reports from people who really don't know anything. people who've challenged the you know extent of this virus thing has been attacked, and they've been attacked by saying people saying, "Well, you're not a doctor." Well, it doesn't keep amateurs from running into my field. Or doctors are always talking about my stuff all the time. But the response to that is, oh, so the reporters who tell you all this, they aren't doctors, huh? Because everything has to go through them. Expertise is now a slave to those who control newspapers and news media. And of course, the press has been ridiculously irresponsible about all of this. People in even Trump's administration are talking about tens of millions of deaths. They're going to pack hospitals with people, not necessarily sick, but either with mental problems or people who think that they're sick, which I guess is one and the same. That's what happens when reality is removed. Modernity, modernism at least had the benefit of it about being real things, objects in space and time. But the postmodern idea, our age, removes even that. That's something even Plato didn't foresee. Where now you have nothing but a void, and those powerful enough to tell you that the void is actually something. And they could put labels on it and have emotions attached to it, and they could use images repeated over and over again on a screen to convince people of this. And therefore, those philosophers, in the very broad sense of the word, are going to be marginalized, are going to be poor, and are going to be hated. This is why Socrates was executed, and for a very similar reason, this is why Christ was executed. Very similar idea. Those who represent the truth, or in Christ's case, are truth, coming into a horribly corrupt world, are only going to get a handful of followers. Because only a handful are smart enough and independent enough to do this. Being independent is hard. Now, you could be independent and wrong. The truth, the fundamentals are absolutely essential, and the truth never changes. But to get there, you have to be humble, you have to completely efface yourself, and you have to not care of the consequences. Self-interest can never be a part of it, because self-interest will distort everything you believe. Which is actually easy to find. Once you do that, you can reach the truth of any particular matter that you're interested in. And then, of course, all those taken together is the truth. But the truth that creates that is the one which is beyond space and time. That's a very, very, very thumbnail sketch of Dugin's more recent work on Plato. And the connection between ontology and metaphysics on the one hand and politics on the other. Thank you everyone for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.